Hello. Today is Thursday, September 6, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Cynthia Gustafson. Today's session number is GUC 2001-4, and it's titled Through the Rivers. Let's listen in.
Cynthia Gustafson, God calls your name in Charleston Whispers, and today I'll be through the rivers. It's September 6th.
It sounds like Monty.
Very strange songs. Well, we'll ignore them unless they come in here. Okay, keep that up until we need it.
Hallelujah,
amen. Is that what I heard? I was going to start with today. We're talking about through the rivers, and I've interpreted that as how do we hear God through nature. I've had a very liberal interpretation all week. The through the waters, I interpreted how do we hear God through family and birth and baptism. Through the fires, how do we hear God through adversity? And today, through the rivers, I've interpreted as how do we hear God through nature? So that's what we're going to talk about. And Pastor Peter's, it's almost like a devotion, but the Bible study this morning, he had us writing. And I wanted to read what I wrote about how I found God as a child. Because I had thought about it, but I hadn't thought about it in quite this way. But I realized that really I found God through nature as a child. I belonged to a church that wasn't very inspiring. And I didn't have people in my family who talked about God. And I really did find God through nature. This is what I wrote. As a child, I heard God in the stream. The eddies around the stones rushed like the hallelujahs of the church songs. Home was quiet, but the creek laughed. It rushed. It never quit. Even in the frozen winter when pipes froze and heat was nowhere except in the flowing creek. So cold, but warmer than the below zero air. Warmer than the metal pipes, always welcoming me. Always flowing, always present. A place of escape, a place of peace, a place of movement, a place of coolness in the heat and warmth in the frozen dark winter. God was there, is still there.
Now, were you aware of these thoughts as being God's presence as a child? Or in hindsight, are you saying this is what...
Yeah, no, I'm looking in hindsight. As a child, a child doesn't think about those things, they feel them. And I felt that, but I couldn't have verbalized that to you. But as an adult, you look back with adult eyes, and then you can verbalize what those feelings were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do any of you have any experiences like that with nature?
Yeah, I can remember that we kind of first really being out of the city into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And I really as a young child, and it's been so important to me through my life.
Right. So you grew up in the city and you would get out into nature?
Occasionally,
See, I grew up out in the country. Uh-huh. And nature was my playmate, really.
Uh-huh.
Because I really was very far away from everyone except for my brother and sister, who I didn't like. And when I was out in nature, I was alone. They didn't come with me. I was alone. And I knew where the berry bushes were. They didn't know where they were. I knew where the wild asparagus grew. And I knew where the birds lived and where the trout were in the creek. If my brother and sister wanted to know that, they would ask me. So that was, nature was my playmate, really, as a child. And, you know, looking back at it as an adult, I mean, it was a very spiritual experience. Really, really lovely. Okay, well, I'm going to read a couple of poems of mine, which are definitely nature poems, but every one of them also says some aspect, that nature poems tells some aspect of my feelings about something. This first one, and I read this one at the reading the other night, but this is called The Patience of the Cross Timbers, and I want to talk about it because right in the title I've said patience, okay, which is something which I think is really important and a lot of us don't have. But there's the asterisk. Let's look at this little part down on the bottom first here. The cross timbers are the remains of the south central old growth forest called the cross timbers, made up mostly of post oak and red cedar, ranging in age from 300 to 1,000 years. And these trees were just discovered in 1999 in Oklahoma. Before that, they didn't know that they had these really, really old trees there. And they're just incredible trees. But you don't know that they're old until you either are told by someone or you look at a cross-section of them under a microscope, because there's so many teeny little circles. So this is Patience of the Cross Timbers. Hundreds of years growing on a steep hill, desolate, aging despite scarce nourishment, they wait for history to recognize them. Crooked cedars, centuries old, twist in the shifting light of seasons and cling to a long-forgotten hill shared by 300-year-old post oaks. Every head cut off by lightning, every stump holding out side limbs like wires on ragged and weathered clothesline poles. Recorded history reveals itself in the cross timbers' rings, some narrow as a spider's thread, examined not by eye but magnified to count each period of drought, season of rain, each scarring fire, tornado, flood, times of settlement and grazing. Washington Irving slept here among the timbers, now a century older, and proclaimed them beautiful. They have waited these years to hear it once again. I wait. Transition is permanent. I understand these trees which grow around rock and moss, trees which stretch limbs in crooked lines, seeking elusive light, trying to catch the runaway water, clinging to life long enough to leave a legacy on the land before becoming firewood. Their endurance, spirituality of patience, their mandala of encyclopedic rings, what they have is what I want. Okay, let's talk about this for a little while. I think it's really interesting that the reason these cross timbers have lasted so much longer than the other cross timbers is why? Why do these still survive? Did anybody catch that?
They were slated broken.
Here, what did you say?
Well, they've been broken. I mean, nobody wanted them for timber if their tops had all been broken.
That's right.
And they were small.
They're very small. And nobody wanted them. Right. And they were in areas that, I mean, you couldn't cut them very well because they're on these steep, you know, cliffs and that kind of thing. And so they lasted because they really didn't fit in with everything else.
They were perfect.
Yeah. They were perfect. That's right. And so they lasted. And, you know, when it says Washington Irving slept here among the timbers, he did. That's true. 100 years ago, Washington Irving passed through that part of the country and actually wrote about this forest, that these cross timbers. Well, that was 100 years ago, and so these trees have just stood there and waited for 100 years to be written about again, you know, to be noticed, to be seen. What does it mean when I say I understand these trees which grow around rock and moss, which stretch their limbs, you know, seeking light, and the water that they get is runaway water. It's water that's running down the slope. It's not just sitting for them with compost around it. Clinging to life long enough to leave a legacy before becoming firewood. Okay? These are trees, again, which are kind of outsiders, aren't they? They're trees that shouldn't be outsiders because they've been there for 300 to 1,000 years. Yet nobody sees them. It's almost as if they're invisible. Nobody cares about them. All those kinds of things. And yet, what am I saying? What have they developed because of that?
Well, they grasp onto any little thing that would help them to exist.
Right. And they have, they have definitely have endurance. Mm-hmm. The spirituality of patience, which is very patient.
survivors.
And the mandala of encyclopedic rings. One of the other things the scientists told us is that by examining those rings, even though they you have to look at them under a microscope, you can tell. You see where I set up there that you can count the droughts, the rains, the tornadoes, you can see all of that in the rings. Mm-hmm. They can tell, when there's been a fire, when there's been a drought, all of those by examining these very tiny rings on these trees. So it really is an encyclopedia as well. I mean, they're just unbelievably interesting.
What does mandala mean?
Does anybody know what a mandala is? Okay. Well, that's an Eastern religious term. Mandalas are always round, and they're... You can draw mandalas. How do I explain them? It's a spiritual exercise. That you have a circle, and then there's a... how do you say it? It's a visual representation of spirituality, but it's always in a circle. And they can be all different kinds, but that's why I'm using that particular word, because it's always in a circle, and it's a spiritual picture, kind of. If I had a dictionary, you'd get a much better definition.
I'll find it.
Okay. So I put what they have is what I want. So what I'm saying here is, I'm looking at a piece of nature here, which is a very unique piece of nature, and I say, what can that tell me? Where is God in this? Where is God in this? When I look at the cross timbers, does God shout to us, or does God whisper to us?
Whisper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to listen very carefully. You have to look very carefully, don't you, this particular one? Yeah. I mean, a rainbow, what does God do to you in a rainbow?
Shout.
That's a shout. You don't even have to be looking. It's just there. It's just wonderful. But this is kind of a whisper. And you really need to look at it and say, what do these trees tell me? Does God talk to me through these trees? It's really, I was just really blessed when I was able to go and walk among them. It's really neat. Okay, here's a different one. This is a poem out of my poetry therapy book. It's called Neck Deep in the River and Swimming. And what this one does is it goes from what I used to be to what I've become. And this was written quite a while ago, so it's not what I am now necessarily, but it's a movement poem. It says, this is kind of what I was like before, and I never dreamed that I would become this other person. But again, this is nature. Neck deep in the river and swimming. When I was 10, and shivering alone in a wind-free nook of winter recess, I never dreamed of running wild, racing a 5K at 40 years with blood pulsing into my face, a clinging t-shirt and toe blisters, or biking 20 hilly miles, pumping sweat-oiled muscles, or climbing a foreign mountain where trees will not live high enough to earn a medal for reaching its pinnacle. And when I was 14 and knew everyone was staring at me walking across the cafeteria, head down, hoping to locate a friend, I never dreamed of seeing wild, matching stare to stare with a praying bald eagle, or being hypnotized by the soft brown eyes of the doe grazing in my wildflower patch, or sensing fear in the enormous gold marble eyes of the baby great-horned owl as it stood neck deep in the river, leading, or bonding with my baby's eyes, the Michelangelo spark of creation burning through my sockets. And when I was 18 and leaving for college, forgetting to kiss my mother goodbye, I never dreamed of loving wild, a child so precious I would not bear another for 7 years, and her father so patient he waits while I discover the wild abandon of losing control, and of loving myself, whose hearty laughter nourishes me as it echoes from mountaintops, dense forests, deserts, inner cities, and inner spaces, and translates the joy of wilderness into sound, O blessed wild. So this poem since it ends with the words, "Oh, blessed wild," is really a celebration of the wild and the wilderness. And if I were to look back at my childhood, other than the times when I was wandering out by myself out in nature, what I was being taught at home was control, control, control. Bernice knows my mother. Maybe she doesn't realize that she was so into control. But, I mean, that's what I was being taught, that I was here to work hard and to be in control of that, always to be in control, to work, and to be a servant as well. I mean, but that was part of work, that's what life was about, working hard and trying to control whatever you had, you know, the best you could. And this poem is more a celebration of the wild, you know, when I was young and I was learning control and all those kinds of things. I never realized that I could actually climb a mountain, you know, a mountain that was above the tree line, and they'd give me a little a thing to put on my hat because I actually made it to the top. I mean, wow! You know, when would I have ever guessed that? How about any of you? What kind of expectations about nature and wellness have you learned, or has your mind changed since you were a child?
Well, growing up in the city, it was just a wonderful thing to go to camp or to go out, you know, like you said, to get out of being in that area, you know, because you didn't realize. And I remember Beverly, when she taught up in Minnesota, she said it was so wonderful because these children would walk in, and they would come in and they'd talk about the things they had seen, you know, deer or whatever. We never had that, you know, in the city. So
I think I took nature for granted as a child. I grew up on a farm, and I mean, the whole world was there for us. Didn't really think about it. I mean, I enjoyed it, I remember.
Yeah.
You know, especially loving warm summer days and
riding
my bike on the bumpy field road. And,
But you know, when you bring up the idea of a farm, again, the farm is not wild, is it?
Well, that's true.
Farm is very controlled.
Yeah.
You know, it's planted, it's harvested, it's thought about before it's planted, it's harvested. You know, that's us taking control of nature, the farm. And yet, kids who grow up on farm do know what the wild is, because you get off the farm and you explore the trees behind you or the old dry run. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing. And so there's, you know, there's always a way to try and discover that. But, you know, how is it as an adult? How do we get that experience of wellness when we can't be here at Holden? I mean, that's the precious thing about Holden Village. Mm-hmm. To have the deer walking through the village.
That's wonderful. That's one of the wonderful things about traveling.
If we can get to a place where everybody else isn't.
Right.
No, because, I mean, I know my husband and I went to the Grand Canyon at Christmas time, which was a fabulous time to go because there were very few people there. And there had just been a major snowstorm.
That's it.
And it cut out a lot of people who would be there. But they gave us stories of what it was like in the summertime, where there were miles of cars backed up to get in.
Right.
And that you couldn't even see things because there were so many people. Plus the fact that they had so much more pollution that you couldn't see across the canyon in the summer, whereas if you come in the winter, especially after a snowstorm, we saw totally across. It was just beautiful and clear. So it's, you know, in the world that we live in with the population that we have, it's very difficult to find wildness without, you know, a lot of other people.
We took the time just to drive out this time because, you know, I've been out this way in an airplane. You don't know what's down here, but it's just a completely different pictures going through the mountains.
Right. Okay. Let me do this one next. Because this one, I think, has a theological question in it. This is called "Someone's Fishing at the Bottom of the Dam." He could have walked upstream and tossed his bait into tranquil, easy waters, but he aims for fish who live in turbulence, who swim between the falls, frothing bubbles and eddies. Above the dam, water lies flat, painted in blues, greens, root beer, a smooth platter for loons and gulls. But in the great gush of falling, those colors fuse into white, splashing into upward risings, then fall again to bump and seethe, foam and thunder, protesting gravity's pull. I would not choose to be the fisher in the turbulence below the dam. I prefer the taste of trout who live in peace. But he knows these fish are easier to catch, the ones who have fallen and who swim within the circles of bright white water. Okay, I'm playing with the idea here of vulnerability. Okay, this whole idea of, you know, above the dam, I think we spend a lot of our time swimming, you know, above the dam. And it's peaceful there, and we feel pretty safe there. We fall down through the dam, through the waterfall, and we're more vulnerable down at the bottom. Do we have any fishermen here, or fisherwomen?
No. No. Upon occasion.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about the technicality of is it easier to catch fish at the bottom of the dam or, you know, above it?
No, in our area, dam, that's where you usually see them fishing for walleye.
Below it. Like
below the dam.
Right, right. And see, this is in Tulsa, and there's a dam, and that's where the fishermen are. I mean, I always see them down there at the bottom of the dam fishing. And so, I mean, this is my poetic mind that's putting together these concepts of the fact that, okay, they're not in the peaceful waters up here. They've gone through the waters. It's kind of like like yesterday's subject. They've walked through the fire. And they're down there in the vulnerable area, aren't they? And they're easier to catch. So what does that say about us as human beings? You know, we've gone through the waters and we've fallen down the waterfall, and we're down there in the vulnerable area.
Is God the fisherman?
Well, let's ask the question. If God were the fisherman, what would this poem be saying?
That we find God more easily, or more open to finding God when we're go through crisis or times of
have you found
trials?
God?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, that's when we're vulnerable. That's when we need something, isn't it? We really do. Okay, and I think what we've been talking about the whole time is, you know, I call you. God calls your name. You know, I call your name. You are mine. And sometimes we don't hear the name until we've gone through that waterfall, and we're down there in those. In that water at the bottom of the dam, and we're feeling very, very vulnerable, and all of a sudden we hear the worm drop in front of us. And we take the bait, and we finally listen. Yeah. So anyway, that's my idea about vulnerability. And I think quite often nature does that to us. I mean, if we climb to the top of the mountain, how big do we feel? We feel very vulnerable, don't we? My son Kent talks about going up to Martin's Ridge, which is back here, which there are trails up there. They just bushwhack up the mountain and go, and they get to the very top of the ridge. And he says the top of the ridge is this wide. And they walk the whole ridge, you know, this wide on bare rock. And they walk all the way on the top of the ridge, Martin's Ridge, and then come back down the other side. That's really being vulnerable, isn't it? And I think that's what nature can do to us, is kind of put us back to size.
Because I find being back to size just driving through the mountains. I mean,
yes,
these huge mountains on each side, and you feel about a quarter of an inch tall.
Yeah, right. which is really different than how we feel in our communities and in our cities, especially when we get to be, I think everybody is here is, you know, middle-aged or older. Once we get to be middle-aged or older, we become the leaders. We become, you know, the bank presidents, the people who make all the decisions. We become pretty big in our communities. Mm. And then we go back into nature, and what does nature do for us? I think it shows us our vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I think, at least for me, it's easier to hear God call my name mm-hmm. when it's out here. Okay. This one. This one's written kind of tongue-in-cheek. I think it says something about us. Thieves. I actually wrote this in Mississippi on the dock in Mississippi as I was watching fishermen down there. Thieves, blasted pinfish, steal shrimp bait meant for flounder that pricks his pins into my flesh as I set him free. It's Sunday on the dock and I don't need his trouble. I walk the beach but receive no gift. The empty shell houses a hermit crab who stole it first and challenges me to a duel. Thieves they are, refusing to respect my ownership of empty shell and shrimp, of fish and ocean swell, and all the sands that tumble and fall and shift and scratch and finally catch in my tight leather shoe. I'm trying to think if I can get so you can see the whole thing together there. I guess that's probably the best. I'm using myself, I use the word I here, as kind of a representative of the American or a lot of people. And I'm dealing with the issue of control here. Okay, who has control? Who does the I think has control? The I in this poem, who does the I think has control or should have control? I think I should have control of all these things, you know? I should be able to get that shell. I should be able to take that fish. It shouldn't have to, you know, prick me with the pins of the pinfish. And they're just not accepting that these are mine, you know? This is my beach and I own these things. I mean, I think since I grew up in nature, and never really felt ownership of it, but really, I think I grew up more like a Native American, you know, just kind of appreciating what's there. And I learned very early on that if I picked black caps, which are black raspberries, if I picked black caps so that I trampled down the bushes, in other words, if I tried to get the black caps way back there by trampling down the bushes in front of me, guess what happened next year?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't there. They were gone. Because the bushes that have the black caps for next year are already there. They don't have berries on it this year. But the bushes are there. And if I trample those bushes, they're gone. There are no berries next year. And I learned that really fast. That if I wanted to have my berries next year, I had to take very good care of the bushes that were here now. And so I kind of learned that on my own as we... You know, as I just, nobody ever told me that. I learned it. And so I kind of learned that nature had its own life and that I could fit in with that life, but I wasn't going to control it the way my mother and my grandmother would talk about controlling life or even life on the farm, how they could control things. And that's what this poem is about, really. Is that I think too many Americans, too many, should I say, Western mentality people think that we can control all of that. Mm-hmm. Does anybody have any thoughts about that? Does anybody know or have any experience with that kind of feeling? When you went to a place of nature. Well, I know I used to live in Hawaii for 2 years. And tourists would come and see a real manufactured Hawaii, which was beautiful and very clean, and it was all manufactured, but it wasn't quite real. And then when we lived there, we realized, you know, what the real cycle of nature was in Hawaii. And it's quite different than what you see as a tourist.
Well, it's like going to a foreign country and going with a tour group and staying in a Hyatt or a Marriott hotel.
Right.
Or traveling through the countryside and staying in a guest house and talking with people at breakfast in the morning.
Yes. Or even trying to learn the language. Yeah, and speaking with, you know, if that's possible. That's really hard for Americans too, isn't it? Because so few of us know another language.
But how much better a feeling you get for the country if you take the, not the Audubon, but the little roads. And
right.
Yeah. Stay in the guest houses and the hotels.
Acapulco and be in your, you know, resort there, a hotel, and you just walk on the beach and see these people hawking. And,
yes.
You know, a little quarter mile down the road, there's little shacks. And,
right.
Which is the real world.
It's kind of interesting. I'm trying to think of how many years ago this was. Would have been the early 80s. I think it was 1984. My husband and I went to the island of St. Lucia, which is in the Caribbean. And we belonged to a Methodist church at the time, and we went on a Methodist mission down there because the island of St. Lucia is almost all Catholic. And so there are no public schools. There are only Catholic schools for the kids. But there are some Protestants who live there, and they have nowhere for their kids to go to school. So the Methodists had started up a Methodist school for the Protestant kids who lived there. And they had no money, and it was just falling down. So there was a group from our church that went there to do carpentry work, basically, on this school to fix it up. And it was so interesting because we just slept on the floor in the dormitories. And it was all men except for two women, myself and the minister's wife. And we wore slacks. We didn't wear shorts because we knew that wouldn't be accepted there. But we did wear slacks and t-shirts because we'd be working. We were doing carpentry work, you know, during the day and painting, doing that kind of thing. And we would we had brought our own tools and things with us, but they were all confiscated when we got off the plane, so we had to go downtown and buy everything new. And so we walked down with the men, and we bought, you know, lumber and all kinds of tools. And the natives saw we two women. They didn't ever talk about the men. They just talked about we two women carrying, like, we had a long board, and she was at one end, and I was at the other, and we, you know, carrying the board back to the school. And they were so amazed there that these women would be doing that kind of work. But the reason I'm telling you this story, I knew I'd get around to this, is that we worked 12 hours a day, which is basically how long the sun was up. And then when the sun was going down, we would go to the ocean and swim, and that's how we cleaned ourselves up because there were no showers. But we would go for a swim every single evening. And at the end of the week, we did not realize this, but at the end of the week, the natives, the church people there, the Methodist church people, told us that all the natives in town were talking because we white people were swimming at the black beach.
Oh. And you had no idea that.
Well, they're all black, and that was the community beach.
Oh.
You see? And so we went swimming at the community beach, but it never occurred to us that that meant that was the black beach, you know, the black person's beach. And we just all laughed at it. It was really funny, but they liked that idea. That was not a bad thing. You know, they liked that did not matter to us. Because at that time, St. Lucia was just becoming a tourist place. There were a few little hotels, and people came by boats. You know, they were on the tour boats. And they would come to the hotels and, you know, go downtown and buy a colorful dress or something, and that's all they saw of the native people. But it was so interesting, I think, that that we just accepted, you know, their version of, you know, that's where their nature was, and we went to the same place. It was really beautiful.
I'm thinking of talking about control, and we seem to think that we have control until natural disasters occur.
Right.
And the floods along the Mississippi River about 5 years ago, which wiped out a good number of farms all the way from Minnesota south.
Yeah.
Or tornadoes or hurricanes that hit the East Coast and wiped out the pig farms in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it always just strikes home that all of a sudden we don't have control.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That we thought we had.
I have a poem about that, and I didn't bring it because it's not in either of these books, but I call it Reclamation, and it's about that flood in the Mississippi. And I've written the poem. It's quite long, and I've written the poem, and it starts very, very narrow, and it gets very, very wide at the end because that's what happens with the river. It starts small, and it gets very, and that's how I've written this, what the poem looks like. But I loved writing that poem because it was about how the river took over. You know, and we think we are in such control. You know, our engineers, you know, have engineered all of this and everything. And every once in a while, the river just tells us we are not in control.
And it has such power. I mean, it's amazing to stand and look down on the floodwaters.
Right.
And the power, I mean, it from a distance, it looks smooth. And even, and like it's not moving very fast. And if you look down on it, it's moving extremely fast and powerfully. I mean, you can feel it within you.
Right. And what happens during disasters? What happens to people?
People,
they come together.
They
come to help.
The first flood that I remember in Minnesota was in 1965, which was the year I graduated from high school. And that Easter, before I graduated from high school, the St. Croix, I lived right on the St. Croix, the St. Croix flooded, you know, before it went into the Mississippi. And what was so interesting to me is that I was filling sandbags next to, well, if you're from Minnesota, you know that the state prison is in Stillwater. And I grew up in Stillwater. And I was filling sandbags next to prisoners. You know, nobody was afraid of these men. They were all filling sandbags, and they were much stronger than we were. And it was, you know, I'd hand them a bag, and they'd, you know, put the sand in the sandbag. And I just thought it was a wonderful, wonderful experience because they were actually part of our community that day. I mean, it was really, it was something that I will never forget. That was really interesting. But it happens in almost every disaster. You know, then no matter who they are,
a lot
community.
More disasters than sometimes. I mean, you know, we saw a lot of Davenport, Iowa, which is my hometown, and you know, it's a couple blocks down there that the downtown floods. Mm-hmm. Nobody, you know, gets hurt. They do put sandbags in the baseball stadium, but the media, you know, can just make.
Oh, and the baseball stadium flooded because of the wind, which broke the dike. Mm. Otherwise, it would have been just fine.
Right,
but.
We
live
on
like the whole town
the Illinois
was
side, and we had no problem, you know, because they do have
that's it.
Right. Is Davenport the town that has decided not to build a levee?
Well, they haven't really decided. It's under discussion and has been every time it floods.
Right.
Because the waterfront downtown is lovely the way it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. And that you just know it's going to flood every once in a while.
So now they're investigating temporary walls, you know, things that can be put in place. I don't know why that happened.
Interesting.
It's under discussion.
This isn't exactly related, but I can't help but think of it when you talk about control. We've been fortunate to be able to choose to live near the salt water, and it's very exciting because of the animals that we see. And we've lived in two different places and never felt like the beach was ours, that was the place for general walking. And when we moved to our most recent spot, our kids came out visiting to see this, and we tramped down and went quite a ways, and someone yelled at our daughter-in-law to get off our property. We were down a ways on the beach, and I never thought the beach really, I mean, supposedly you own so many feet and so far out in the Thailands, but you know, it's just an amazing concept to me that people want to control this thing that I think belongs to everybody.
Yes.
And to yell at someone to get off the beach is just awful.
Isn't that amazing? Bernice, do you want to tell them about Lake Geneva? What does Lake Geneva have?
Yeah, Lake Geneva, you can't...
This is in Wisconsin.
Can't block people from walking around the lake.
Oh, good.
You know, they have a walk. They even have a pamphlet now that says, walk, talk, and gawk.
Oh!
You walk and you can talk to your, you know, whoever's with you. And then they tell you about, you know, different things going around the lake. Yeah. So
tell them. I mean, these are not just normal little houses.
No, they're beautiful. Big Wrigley has an estate there, and
I don't know how you get people to think in large terms like that.
Well, even our little town of Williams Bay, it's something like a little fishing village, and. They came in with developers because it's developing, you know, around Lake Geneva. And this group of people, the citizens, they decided they didn't want what they were going to put there because we've got, it's a spring-fed lake and you have these underground springs that go to feed the lake. So they got after the DNR and they got after all these groups. And finally, the developers gave up. So now we have a nature walk there, you know, a nature place that people can come and see all these things. So it pays sometimes to be
to be vocal.
To be vocal.
Right. We have some wonderful walking and bike paths along the Mississippi in the Quad Cities, and there is one short section in Bettendorf, which is directly along the Mississippi. There's a railroad track between the houses, street, railroad track. Grass before you get to the river, and there's a short section that people evidently own the property on the other side of the railroad track, and will not let the bike path go through. They've been working at it. I mean, there are about 5 or 6 pieces of property that will not allow the bike path.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Kind of in the same thing that we're talking about. My grandmother, the farm that my mother grew up on in Minnesota, in southern Minnesota, her parents sold it in probably the early 1960s and moved into town, you know, retired from the farm and moved into town, and they sold it to somebody else. And according to my grandmother, they sold the farm they counted how many acres were tillable. And they sold those acres, and then they threw in the acres that were hilly and you couldn't cut the trees on them and all of that kind of stuff, and the Cannon River flows right through it, and they just gave that to them, that property. And about 5 years ago, the people who bought the property from my grandparents sold the property to the state of Minnesota for a state park because of the land that they had gotten free because all the wildflowers grew along the river there because it had never been tilled, you know, and this was really very a native land. I mean, it had not been, you know, changed at all. And my grandmother found out about that. She said, how could the state of Minnesota take my taxes? How could it be so stupid to pay money for that land? We gave it to them free. Oh, it's so funny. But she did not, till the day she died, did not understand the concept of wildness, that everything had to be controlled and conquered. And if you couldn't control it, it was worthless. I mean, that was her generation. She was born in 1898.
That's kind of how my mom owns part of the farm near Lewiston, Idaho, and she and the other owners are selling it, and they say we have X number of acres of tillable land and X non-tillable, and there's a different price per acre on each one.
And which costs more?
The tillable.
Right. Well, because people make their living.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's another kind of a correlation between the stuff that is controlled and non-controlled with, like, the Snake River and the Columbia. You know, the Columbia is controlled. It's got so many dams on it. It's now fairly safe.
Yeah.
But in the past few years, there's been a couple of times. One is one of my uncle's granddaughters, and another is just a couple of people that were known by somebody else I knew, gone down there and just drowned in the Snake, not realizing how wild it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're gone.
You know? Right. And I think that's because in the world that we live in, everything is so controlled. Or if it isn't controlled, there's usually a sign that warns you. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you somehow make your way into an area that doesn't have a sign, a lot of people just don't understand the concept of what the wild can really be.
Mm-hmm.
How awesome it can be. I mean, really awesome. But you know, I'm still trying to get back to the subject of, you know, God calls our name through shouts and through whispers. Well, I think, you know, when it comes to something like that, I mean, if a person were to do that and survive, you know, and not die but and survive, that would be a shout, you know. Mm-hmm. If you go somewhere and survive, I know my daughter used to be in geology. She isn't anymore, but she was in Idaho one summer all by herself climbing mountains, and she said she got stuck on a mountain and couldn't get down at night, and she didn't tell me this for 3 years. She said, I didn't want to tell you. She said, I almost didn't survive. And she had gone up in shorts, and it had gotten very, very cold, and she really almost had... Hypothermia. And she said it was really a severe life staying up there on the mountain by herself, you know, just shivering all night, being really cold. But those kinds of experiences change you, you know, that if you do come back again, I mean, you realize the awesome strength of nature. And again, that can be a metaphor for the awesome strength of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's been kind of interesting this week. Bernice and I have been getting to know Katerina, who is German and is working here in the village, and she's a kind of girlfriend of my son. And we've been talking to her, and in Germany, she said she came over here really with a strong belief that God is a God to be feared. And her minister over there, before she came over here, said, be aware of the fact that Americans think that God is a loving God.
Wow.
He said that to her. Be aware that Americans think that God is a loving God. This is a Lutheran minister in Germany, in Bavaria. And so she came over here, and of course that is what she finds. She really finds that here at Holden. You know, that God is a loving God.
And does she feel that way now? Or is she still in fear?
The feeling is still back there in Germany, mm-hmm. but she's thinking about mm-hmm. it. You know, what we think and what we feel are quite mm-hmm. often two different things. But if we don't start thinking about it, the feelings don't change.
Mm-hmm. So. She's grown up with that.
Right.
She's
yes.
only been here a few weeks.
So right.
That could change.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Basics.
Yeah. And the question is, because... the whole German attitude toward Americans in general is that we don't want the world to become Americanized. We need to keep who we are, and you see, who our, you know, our belief in God is part of who we are.
I wonder why they think that. I mean, Martin Luther was a good German, and he was by grace, you know,
yes.
and was a loving God by grace.
I know. I don't know where that came from, except that it's, I think it's part of the culture. I mean, the culture, and when I talk about this grandma of mine that was so
controlling.
She was 100% German. I mean, it came right from that culture.
It's the so. Bavaria area where she's from. The,
yeah, that's
the happy, fun, loving
right.
people.
Right.
So
yeah.
If she was northern German, I could see it.
Yeah.
Do you think it's totally fair, or do you think some of that's respect and just maybe that we have a more familiar...
I think some of it, I think you're right about that, that it's more awesome.
Uh-huh.
Don't forget to be awestruck.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of thing.
Instead of being friend.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and this hasn't always been true in America either.
No,
and
I know.
You know, you grew up in fear. Don't do this and don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. fear.
Mm-hmm. You know, in some groups, religious groups, it is.
It's still a way, right.
Yes,
Katrina.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, I think nature, you know, suggests all of those things to us. I mean, it suggests being awestruck.
Mm-hmm.
It also suggests love. It suggests fear. It suggests all those things. So God can speak to us in many different ways, I think.
We talked with several of you about our daughter's wedding a couple of weeks ago, and it was the possibility of rain on that Saturday. And I've always felt, you know, no matter what you do, you have no control over the weather, so you accept, you know, what happens, you know. And I've said that many times when we've done outdoor things. But Katie said to me, well, you know, rain is kind of cozy. And we had a thunderstorm early in the morning that Saturday. Uh-huh. And then it cleared up and it was a lovely afternoon. A rainbow came out when the kids came over to our house between the ceremony and the reception in the evening, and they had come over on buses. And while they were at our house, this wonderful rainbow came out. And it was just kind of neat for the whole day.
And she will always remember that.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, that is fabulous. This is another poem I read at my reading the other night, but it brings up another subject when it comes to nature. We can go over this. Holy War. You do not have to forgive spotted deer who eat tender leaves off your apple tree, or borers who devour your sweet yellow corn, or ants who march into your kitchen as soldiers in a holy war. You do not have to forgive birds who nest in your chimney, or families of moles who mound your manicured yard, unless you value wildness, unless you have ever followed an unknown trail. And you do not have to forgive the animal who, when drunk, smashed your pottery turtle from the rock garden where it stood watch over hens and chickens, monkey grass, and violets. You do not have to forgive the animal who left shattered pieces for you to find, shards of shell among the perennials, unless you value inner peace, unless you have ever thrown a photo frame against stone. And I think this suggests, wow, when you look at nature, and when I say that, I want you to think about all those shows that we watch on public TV, you know, that shows the cougar eating the rabbit.
Part of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we grow up, we think Bambi is so sweet. You know, nature is so sweet. And then your kids sit there and watch these nature shows on TV, and they aren't sweet. You know, they aren't sweet at all. Oh, those eagles that are so beautiful and represent the United States are carnivores. I mean, wow, they go down and claw that fish. I've seen them do it and eat it. You know, these bears that we just think are so beautiful, and the cougars, you know, they're dangerous. So, you know, when we look at this creation, and people say, oh, I see God in creation. I see God in nature, in wildness. That raises that question. You know, it really raises the question of, you know, there's violence that's really programmed right into wildness, into our existence. And where is God in that? And I'm just throwing that question out. Does anybody have a response? Or we can go the easier thing, which I've mentioned in here about deer coming in and eating your apple trees. Boy, I had a problem with that for a while. I kept planting more apple trees, and the deer kept eating the little buds off it. I just couldn't get them to grow. I was so frustrated, but I loved the deer.
Do we liken that wildness of the wild kingdom to the wildness of, you know, nasty individuals in the human race? I don't know. Should one, or... I mean, we have rational choice, I guess, as a human race.
Well, the human race, we are animals within the kingdom.
You know, it's part of our choice that we got all those deer around, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, when I was a young kid, I never saw a deer, you know, and you never saw
rare.
An odd
yes,
or Wisconsin, it would be so rare. Now they limit it, and they've got so many insurance companies that probably wish hunting season would be forever. So.
And they become in the suburbs is where they are, because
in the city, right?
In the city,
right down.
Oh.
So I mean, part of that is our, you know, whether it's a fault or what it is.
Right.
When you look at something like that as a single act, it seems violent and kind of foreign, I guess. But when you look at it as the total nature cycle.
Right.
Like you look at forest fire being bad, but yet you need the forest fires to regenerate the forests, then it's good.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
So taking
but
an isolation, you tend to
context,
you see it in the wrong context.
Yeah. tell about this when I, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, the deer eating off the apple trees and the, you know, the moles that, do you have moles that mount up here mm-hmm. and you have to walk on? I mean, they're always ruining our lawn. You know, again, we can get so angry. Oh, I get so angry at the squirrels. Oh, I get so angry at the squirrels. Because they're, I can't control them, you know. And their nature, which is in the area that I think I can control because I'm in a city and I can't do it. And how do I answer that question in this poem? Unless you value wildness, you know. Unless you have ever taken, you know, a path that wandered off somewhere that wasn't, you know, that wasn't in your program, you know. Mm-hmm. That we have to allow, if we allow ourselves to be part of the wilderness and value the wilderness, then we also have to value any of that wilderness which, you know, intrudes upon our lives.
Or accept that that's the way it is.
Yes, right. And actually even, even call it blessed, because the less of that we have in the city, the more sterile the city gets. You know, if you understand what I'm saying. What are we going to do here? Okay. Let's see if I have covered all of this. So I guess my last question that I would kind of leave you with is, why does nature lead us to God? Or to meaning, you know, if you don't want to say to God. Why, you know, in what way? And I want you to think about, you know, when you're out in nature, you know, is God shouting to us? Is God whispering to us? And what is the message? You know, that when you look at an old tree, what is the message that tree, you know, God through that tree is giving us? If we walk up to Heart Lake, you know, and your heart is beating really fast by the time you get there. I make you play on the word heart here. But I walked up there yesterday and my heart was beating very fast by the time I got up there. What does that lake say to us? Why is that a spiritual place? And we haven't really talked about that yet. You know, what is a spiritual place and why is it spiritual? But, you know, you go up to a place like that surrounded by mountains and these enormous pine trees, you know, and there was some kind of big bird out in the lake. I don't know what it was. It looked kind of like a heron, but it wasn't any heron I'd ever seen before. And you ask yourself, why is this place spiritual? Why do I hear God here? Why do I feel it here? And my other question would be, if you want to go off and write something, which I do encourage, think about this. Write about the holiest place I know. And why is that place holy? And what does it tell me? And what does it feel like? So I'll leave you with that thought that you might like to write about.
Write about the holy city of Jerusalem.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to see it as holy right now, isn't it? That's for sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.